There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Previously, in episode 4 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, Unknown Subject.
When you get a murder that's like this, is, and you have not much of anything to go on, and you do a lot of wheel spinning.
Back in the early days of DNA, it took so long, to get your result.
CODIS notified Montgomery County that there was a match to, like 8 rapes that they had up there. And I contacted Joe Madonna.
Do you recall getting the notification that the Mirzayan murder was connected to your rape cases?
Yeah, I do. And I was like shocked.
It's a Thursday in June in 2012, 6 months after the FBI joined the search for a serial predator. They were now calling the Potomac River Rapist. Reporters in Washington, D.C. were told for the first time in years that D.C. police had new information in the case. We were told to meet the police chief not at police headquarters, but on MacArthur Boulevard, a leafy street in an upscale section of the city near the German embassy and about a mile from Canal Road, where Christine Mirzayan was killed. When I arrived, I recognized a number of high-ranking police officials, including the two detectives assigned to the case, Todd Williams and Tony Brigadini, as well as Montgomery County Police Detective Joe Madonna. I was also surprised to see John Walsh there. I knew the host of America's Most Wanted had profiled the case before, and I was anxious to hear what he had to say. When then-D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier stepped to the mics, she had surprising news to share. Here's what she told us. After the FBI held its last news conference in December of 2011, a woman came forward to say she thought the man police were looking for, the so-called Potomac River Rapist, had also attacked her 2 years before Christine was killed.
We're again asking for the public's help in identifying and locating this violent offender who's responsible now for several brutal attacks.
When she came forward, the woman was in her 70s, but at the time she was attacked, she was 59. She told police she was walking home from the bank at MacArthur Boulevard and Arizona Avenue, heading southeast towards the Georgetown Reservoir. And as she was passing a dense wooded area that extends down to Canal Road, a man came out of the woods armed with a stick. She tried to run towards the street, but the man grabbed her. There was a struggle. She screamed, but the man overpowered her and dragged her into the woods. The attack was vicious. He stripped her naked, beat her, and raped her, and left her at the bottom of a ravine. When the man ran off, she was able to get back up to the street where two cyclists saw her and called for help. The woman was so badly injured, she spent days in the hospital recovering. She described the man who attacked her as Hispanic or black, tall, with a heavy build and a light complexion. She said he was possibly in his late 30s and neatly dressed, in a collared shirt and chino-type pants. She got a good look at his face, and a composite sketch was made. It sounded chillingly similar to how Christine was attacked, but it had never before been linked to Christine's killing because investigators never tested the evidence.
For whatever reason, I don't know, but her rape kit basically hadn't been processed or at least uploaded into CODIS for the cold hit.
Yes, you heard that right. That's former homicide commander Mike Farish. The evidence taken from the woman in 1996 was collected and preserved in a rape kit, which then sat on a shelf for more than 15 years. A common problem in many police agencies at the time because of the high cost of processing the kits in a lab. If investigators didn't have a solid lead on a suspect, the evidence usually went untested. And when they finally tested the kit all those years later, it was a match. The same man who killed Christine had also attacked this woman. Detective Todd Williams knew he had one opportunity to get the word out, and he wanted reporters to know a few things. The veteran homicide investigator, who shares a resemblance to actor Russell Crowe, said the fact the rapist had struck twice in Northwest D.C. meant he was likely familiar with that part of town and may have had some connection to the area. It may have been a job that took him there, or perhaps he knew someone who lived in the neighborhood. The smallest piece of information could be the lead investigators need to identify this guy. It was a shot in the dark for Detective Williams. 16 years had gone by. Was someone really going to call the police after all that time? John Walsh, who had a reputation for using colorful language, told reporters, "This is a dangerous sexual predator. This is a hunter of women. Somebody knows something about this guy." Later that summer, on June 29th, America's Most Wanted aired an episode featuring the three detectives and D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier discussing the case. All four were interviewed by Walsh in the wooded area where Christine was killed. At the news conference, Detective Joe Madonna, who had been investigating all those rapes in Montgomery County, told reporters this new case gave investigators fresh leads to follow.
Well, this case, I think, in D.C. has the victim actually got a good look at the suspect, where in most of our cases, they did not.
Based on the woman's account, police released a second composite sketch and a description of the suspect. A black man in his late 20s to early 30s, wearing a polo-type shirt and khaki pants. Detectives now have a new key piece of information about their serial predator, but in some ways it's even more perplexing to investigators. Okay, let's take another look at the timeline. Where does this new attack fit? Christine was killed in August 1998. The attacks in Montgomery County began back in 1991. The rapist struck four times that year, then again in early 1992, and 1994. Then there's a 3-year gap with no reported rapes until 1997. It's during this gap that the woman was attacked on MacArthur Boulevard in D.C., July 20th, 1996. And it's a sudden change of tactics. She's pulled off the street and into the woods. Investigators already knew the man was addicted to high-risk attacks, but a street attack was something new. But then in 1997, the rapist goes back to his indoor blitz attacks. In February of that year, he attacks the woman whose husband owned a car dealership. And in November, he attacks the woman who lived in a home with two dogs. The attacker was somehow able to corral. The attack on Christine comes in August of 1998, the last known attack tied to the predator the police were now calling the Potomac River Rapist. Another case on the street rather than inside a home. Detective Dean Combi.
At the time, we all felt that was extremely unusual. You know, because the thinking of at the time was that those guys, you know, that do the preferential kind of stuff like that, you know, they kind of, that the setup is part of the fantasy, and so that they, you know, that's what they get off on. And to do something outside of it would be extremely unusual. So that was kind of, we were just like, because that's why we never would have connected them, because it wouldn't have occurred, you know, it didn't occur to us that was, you know, a thing.
But Detective Combi pointed to an August 2019 article in The Atlantic titled, "Why Don't Police Catch Serial Rapists?" It detailed a 10-year effort by prosecutors in Cleveland to test thousands of old rape kits, some decades old at that point. They ended up indicting more than 700 people by testing every single rape kit. What's more, the article said it's led to a revolution in criminology, giving investigators valuable insight into the criminal mind.
When they started going through and testing all these, they were finding that they had serial rapists that they had no idea were operating, for one thing. And that they had some rapes that were unsolved, of course, but were connected by DNA, that they didn't know who it was, that were, you know, followed a particular pattern. So they had identified those as being, you know, part of the person's series. However, they found that those guys were also committing other rapes that were out of their pattern. They were just more like crimes of opportunity. So the lesson is, the guys will, you know, they may have a preference about what they do or how they want to do it, but if they see an opportunity, they're going to take it, and we'll do it. So, you know, but
is that kind of the thinking now?
That's kind of the thinking now. That's kind of the thinking now.
Yeah.
Because I mean, that's what it shows. You know, I mean, that's what the DNA is showing, not just our supposition or whatever. You know, so, you know, they may have had where they were doing a series and they were raping, you know, women who were in their 30s and, you know, in their homes, and they were breaking in through a window or something like that and getting them or something like that. And then, the DNA results, they were finding that women who were getting attacked outside, in their 70s or in their teens, you know, coming back from the grocery store, stuff like that. And he's just walking down the street, says, "Oh, that looks good," you know, and going over and grabbing them. Now, it's hindsight, of course, but, you know, I might have looked at it, I might have called around earlier to see if there, you know, if they had any unsolved ones around. But, you know, I know we had contacted, you know, various sexual assault units, and nobody really had anything, you know, that kind of jumped out at anybody, you know, at the time.
And the idea that he may have just stopped? Keep in mind, by 2012, there had been no sexual assaults tied to this unknown subject in 14 years.
I just can't wrap my head around this guy committing 8 or 9 heinous offenses, culminating in a murder in 1998, and then he's just going, "Okay, I'm done."
I know. That's the question, isn't it?
That's a huge question for me. He could not have got that out of his system, or whatever you want to call it. I just call BS on that.
That's retired DC Police Homicide Commander Mike Farish. And as an experienced detective like yourself, you find that to be almost, you'd have to suspend reality to believe that he didn't do anything else after he allegedly killed Christine.
Regardless of whether I'm an experienced investigator or not. I mean, if I was a mechanic, you know, and God, I knows I couldn't do that. But if I was even a mechanic, I would not go, "Yeah, this guy just didn't stop. There's just no way. There's just no way." I mean, unless he, and see, I can't even wrap my head around that. Even if he had some kind of medical issue that rendered him impotent, that would, to me, almost make his violence increase, because now he's impotent. He can't exercise his violence through the act of raping somebody. What other heinous crap is he going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't care if he found God and a good woman. This guy has some sick impulses that aren't going to be fixed on their own in any way, shape, or form.
The working theory at the time was the Potomac River rapist was either in prison or dead, not that he had just stopped committing crimes. The discovery of that one rape kit confirming the 1996 attack had detectives wondering if there could be others. But as the years went by and the FBI's CODIS database failed to link any other cases, investigators began to wonder, is it possible? Did he really just stop?
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
For years, DNA was the frontier of solving cold cases. Now, there's something even newer, forensic genealogy. And it's leading to some remarkable discoveries. A number of cases have been solved using forensic genealogy and show some men are capable of committing despicable acts of violence and then going on to lead normal lives. For example, take the case of Jerry Lynn Burns. In February of 2020, a jury in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, convicted Burns in the 1979 murder of Michelle Martinko, an 18-year-old high school student who was found stabbed to death inside her family's car in the parking lot of a local mall. The investigation had gone nowhere until 2006, when a cold case detective reviewing case files discovered unidentified blood he suspected may have been the killer's. A DNA profile was developed, but when it was loaded into the FBI's CODIS database, there were no matches. More than a decade went by before detectives turned to what was their last hope, forensic genealogy, and the DNA from the blood was entered into GEDmatch, the same genealogy website used to catch the Golden State Killer. A family tree was built, and investigators narrowed their search to three brothers. One by one, investigators tailed the siblings, surreptitiously collecting DNA the men had discarded, and one by one, the brothers were ruled out until they got to Jerry. Detectives collected a straw from a drink Burns had been consuming at a restaurant, and when investigators had the straw tested at the lab, they were told the DNA was a match to the blood found in the car. Detectives then confronted Burns with a hidden camera inside an office at the Iowa business he owned.
The reality is we're not here on a whim. We're here to confirm what we already know. How would we get your DNA at the crime scene there, Jerry?
I don't know. Test it, see if it is.
No, we did. How would it be there, Jerry?
I don't know.
What happened that night?
Wait for the test to come back.
Jerry,
I don't think it did.
It did.
I don't think so.
When I was researching other cases involving forensic genealogy and learned about this one, I found this exchange gripping. Jerry Burns seems to be in utter disbelief that he'd been found. When detectives ask him, "How did we get your DNA at the crime scene, Jerry?" he says, "I don't know. Test it to see if it is." The detectives told him they already have tested it. It's his. Jerry Burns says, "I don't think so." Although Burns maintained his innocence throughout the trial, he was convicted and is now serving life in prison without the possibility of parole. He is appealing that conviction. Investigators in Montgomery County began using forensic genealogy around 2016, and have had tremendous success solving what for years had been the unsolvable. The cold case unit began by recruiting a bike cop with a natural talent for research and put him to work building family trees. You may remember the name Steve Smugareski from season 2 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place. Smugs, as he's called on the force, is just one of those guys who has a knack for locating people through documents and records. He's the type of guy who can go down the rabbit hole, follow the clues, and actually connect the dots. He had some help. Montgomery County began working with Parabon Nanolabs, a Virginia-based company that specializes in helping police departments find those unknown subjects they've been looking for.
What we do is we analyze the DNA and pick out the pieces of it that actually determine what someone looks like. So instead of treating DNA like a fingerprint, we treat it like a blueprint of that person.
That's Dr. Ellen Graytek with Parabon. She says part of the lab's process is taking an unknown subject's DNA and turning it into a composite sketch, a facsimile of what the person may actually look like, a process that has astounded investigators when they compare the composite to an actual photo of the person they've been looking for. But that's just part of the job. Parabon also takes that DNA and enters it into private databases looking for relatives of the unknown subject. Databases like GEDmatch and FamilyTree, which allow law enforcement to search members' genetic profiles. It's all on the up and up. Members are given the option of allowing those kinds of searches. They can say yes or no. So what Smuggs gets from Parabon is identifying information of someone who may be a distant relative of the unknown subject he's tracking, and he works from there, building family trees. He has been remarkably successful. In just the last few years, he has helped close three cases that had baffled detectives for years, two murders and a serial rapist who had been targeting elderly women. First, let's take that last case. It's interesting to note, while Smuggs had accepted the position in the cold case division, he hadn't officially started yet. He was still working as a bike officer, but his new bosses asked him to take a look at new information they had just received from Parabon Nanolabs.
So I sat down on a Friday night after I got done with my shift, and I just started playing around with a couple genealogy sites, and I started making a few connections here and there, family wise, working up from our shared person. And by midnight on Saturday, I had hit on, because a lot of everybody was coming back to Frederick and West Virginia and such, in different areas, and nobody really to Montgomery County. And then by midnight on Saturday, I hit a line that came back to Montgomery County.
So, all right, so you, by Saturday night, you get a line on a family from Montgomery County, is that right?
Yes.
And tell me about that. What happened next?
Well, I was going to call my buddy in cold case at midnight, and I was like, nah, he's probably asleep.
Because you're excited at this point.
I'm excited at this point. I think I got something, but, you know, I don't know. I haven't been doing this all that long. And so I called him the next morning on Sunday, and... You know, I told him what I found, and at this point I didn't isolate on a single person yet. And we start playing around with a few things over the phone, and he said, "How does this person fit?" And I was like, "Let me check." And I went back to the obituary that I found, and I found his name, and I said, "Well, let me do a little more research," and I found another obituary to tie this person definitely to the tree.
The person Officer Smugareski mentioned fit perfectly into the suspect's description based on the DNA connections in the family tree, but more work needed to be done before detectives were convinced the puzzle pieces fit.
Ultimately, they got a search warrant for his DNA based on their investigation.
And when the lab compared the suspect's DNA with the rapist's DNA, it was a moment Officer Smugareski told me that left him stunned and proud. What did you think at that point?
I was totally blown away. I had thought, really, you know, this is really crazy.
That's right. Officer Smugareski, who had not even technically begun his temporary assignment with the Cold Case Division, had just helped solve a case that had baffled investigators for more than a decade. Marlon Michael Alexander, a father of four, pleaded guilty in February of 2019 and is now serving life in prison. At that point, Smuggs was just getting started. The detectives in Cold Case then asked him to do a deep dive on another cold case, the murder of shopkeeper James Essel. The 57-year-old man was working behind the counter of his market in Comus, Maryland, in a rural part of Montgomery County, when a man walked in and purchased a bottle of cheap wine. Then, in an apparent attempted robbery, things turned violent. James Essel was stabbed 20 times, including with pieces of the wine bottle the killer had just purchased. For years, it was a senseless, unsolved crime. Police had DNA. The killer had cut himself and left blood behind on the cash register. But the DNA profile sat in CODIS, the National DNA Database, for years. There were no hits. Nothing. Then, in 2016, Montgomery County Police turned to forensic genealogy. They were able to build a family tree and trace it first to a man named Henry Ewitz, according to a court affidavit filed in the case, before confirming the man they were actually after was Henry's brother Hans, who was then living in Virginia Beach, working as an auto mechanic and married to a retired D.C. police officer. When police moved in to arrest Hans, investigators say he produced two guns.
Oh, yes, you do. You have kids. Don't do this. Police! Drop the gun, man! Don't do it!
He's got kids.
We're not doing this.
No.
Gun down and talk to him.
I think he's got kids. And they're telling him not to do it for the kids' sake. Oh, he's got multiple guns.
Don't do this! Don't do it! Drop the gun! Drop the gun!
The shooting was ruled justified. What's extraordinary about this case is the fact that police could find no criminal record for Hans Ewitz. It's as if he killed James Essel, according to police, and then, with tremendous remorse, said nothing about it to anyone and decided to live the rest of his life on the right side of the law. Could that also be the case with the man known as the Potomac River Rapist? After his terrifying attacks on women, and after he crossed the ultimate line when he smashed that rock into Christine's head, did he just stop? By 2018, it had been 20 years since the man left his ugly mark anywhere. It had been 6 years since police held that news conference announcing the discovery of the other attack, when John Walsh, the host of America's Most Wanted, pleaded for anyone with information to come forward. Nothing. Fresh off his success in the James Essel case, Montgomery County put Smuggs on the Potomac River Rapist. Smuggs, as he's known, is a big guy with an easygoing manner. He has sandy brown hair and the build of a man who could play tackle or tight end for a football team. When I first interviewed Smuggs, he was not allowed to discuss the Ewitz case or any of his work on the Potomac River Rapist. So instead, to get a feel for how he does his work, I asked him about another case he helped solve, the ugly rape and murder of Lee Batui, a children's hospital research scientist who was found beaten, raped, and strangled outside her Rockville, Maryland home on October 3, 1994. Detectives had DNA, but were never able to link it to a suspect. Just to be clear, this is not a case connected to the Potomac River rapist, but it helps show how Smuggs does his work. Like the Hewitts case, detectives turned to the Virginia-based Parabon Nanolabs for help in locating a family tree with links to the killer's DNA.
In this case, they had sent in to Parabon, and Parabon had come back with that they had found lower matches, which were probably third to fourth, maybe even fifth cousins out. So at that time, it was fall of 2018. Parabon had not recommended that we go forward with the genealogy because it was a lower centimorgan match. It was pretty far out.
A centimorgan is a unit for measuring genetic linkage. It's defined as the distance between chromosome positions, also known as loci or markers.
But at this point, you're on your assignment now?
At this point, I was on my assignment, and Sergeant Homrock came to me and said, what do you think? He said, this is what Parabon's got on it. What do you think on that? And I said, they're pretty far matches, but if we get the information, I should be able to, it's going to take some time, but I should be able to trace this family out.
You were willing to give a shot at it.
I was willing to give it a shot because, yeah. It was the process. It just takes a little time. You just got to get out there and start eliminating lines or see if you come down to a section of the family that is right where our crime is and such.
You're looking for geography in a way?
I look at everything.
Everything.
I look at geography. I look at family dynamics. I look at everything, like where most of the family is concentrated in. Because with the databases, the public databases, if you're five generations out, you could have relatives out in California, and you could be the only person here in Maryland, but all the rest of your family comes from California. And so that's where the records are. That's where you have to search the databases.
And when you search databases, what kind of records are you looking at?
I'm looking for anything that makes a connection, anything that tells me who a parent is or who a child is or who a grandparent is, anything of that nature.
So we're talking about birth records, mm-hmm. death records.
Mm-hmm.
What other records?
Census records, funeral records, obituaries, anything that'll give you another, U.S. public records with like directories and stuff. You can link up stuff with addresses and such.
A deep dive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, and in this case, a very deep dive.
Yes. Yes.
So you get started on it and tell me where it took you.
So we got the return back in January of 2019.
And when you say return, this is from Parabon? Okay.
So they did their 15 hours of genealogy on it, and they worked it from two low matches, which were in the 100 centimorgan range, which is usually between third and fourth cousin, probably closer to fourth cousin. They had worked it to a common ancestor or a common relationship that was several generations back.
Several generations?
Yeah, it was at least four, maybe five generations back. I think it was four generations back. Without my chart in front of me, I can't tell you for sure.
But at this point, you're still sitting there going, I'm going to take a shot at this.
Yeah, yep. So they come back with that, and they said, you can pay for more genealogy, we can work it a little harder, but we don't know if after 15 hours more if we're going to be able to find your suspect or not. So we got the return and they gave it to me and said, all right, what do you think? So I started working on it.
Smuggs worked the case for 2 or 3 weeks before he had to shift back to bike patrol. Still, he kept working on it.
We were taking a break from bike patrol, and I got on the computer and I started doing some of my searches again, trying to update, update my charts and fill in the blocks. And I started seeing, you know, coming down from this relationship, there were several paths that I could take. And I started seeing in one path, all the people were coming up to be too old in the spot that I needed to be. And then...
And when you say you're going, there's several paths you could take. So you could go on one path doing detective work, and you could go down a rabbit hole and be completely wasting your time. So you you have to make a choice at that point, which path to go.
Yep.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
And for me, more information is better. So I like to follow it all the way down to the end, and then at that point, you know, do my research on it or dish it to the detectives and you know, see if we can eliminate that branch or such, and then work down. And in this case, I was doing the one branch, and like I said, everybody was falling too old where I needed them to be. And then another branch, they were falling, were too young where I needed them to be. So I took this other branch and I started working on it. And everybody was coming back to West Virginia, West Virginia roots and such. And I clicked on one public document, and it was a man who lived in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I said, wow, all right, this is the first connection I have to Montgomery County in this case. So then I started playing around with him and found his children. And when I did, I clicked on one of his sons and started doing some research on one of his sons, and all the sons' addresses started popping up in Rockville all around the metro station. And then I started looking at his criminal history, and it was spot on for the kinds of crime, or not rape, but assaults and.
But at this point, not the kind of crimes that would have DNA would have been taken?
No.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing in this case was the phenotype, which is the composite that came back from Parabon Nanolabs. And in this case, it said that the suspect, there was a percentile, a high percentile, that our suspect would have either green or blue eyes. And so I threw his name and everything into a law enforcement database, and popped up with a picture, popped up with his eye color, and I put it next to the composite, and I was like, wow, this is him. His eye color was hazel, was green. And so I called my buddy up in Cold Case and said, I think I got it. And
that's extraordinary. I looked at what you sent me. I looked at the Parabon composite next to his mugshot, and it's astonishing how close they came.
Yeah.
Astonishing.
Yeah.
And so you're now excited, and you're going, I think I might have found him.
I think I found him. And so I sent...
What was the reaction on the other end of the line at that point?
Well, it went to his voicemail. So I left him a message, and then I sent him what I found through email, and then I called him back again because I was really excited. I was like, why aren't you answering your phone? And then finally he called me back, and I said, did you see the stuff I sent you? And he's like, yeah, on the dead guy. And I was like, what do you mean dead guy? And in all my excitement, I overlooked that our suspect died in 2017, and that was a little bit of a letdown at that point. But to still find this person was really exciting, and to be the second time to do it really gave me more confidence that the first time just wasn't a fluke.
And this time it took you how much time?
This time it was, we got the return back in, I believe, mid-January. I don't know the exact date. And then I found him like the second week of February.
Wow. So, that was quick.
Yeah.
So then, you've now had two cases where you found an individual when we know now that they were definitely connected to these cases, and in a matter of weeks you found these people. Mm-hmm. And these are cases that had baffled detectives for years.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
I think I got some help from upstairs.
Really?
I think, you know, it's just very overwhelming, you know, it's some of the stuff to find is really difficult to find, and sometimes I think I got somebody up there point me in the right direction.
Yeah. I can see you're emotional about it. It just goes to show you how important this work is, and how getting answers to things where people have been victims of crimes, brutal, awful crimes, and then you can get answers to it. I mean, that's something. That's saying something. Tell me again how you were able to positively identify this man, and what was his name?
Kenneth Earl Day.
So Kenneth Day is dead, but he has an extensive criminal record, and you told me that there had been an autopsy in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you able to make a definite connection, a DNA connection, between that man and the killing of this woman, the scientist?
Well, we had obtained a blood card from the medical examiner's office in West Virginia, and we were able to do a direct comparison of the DNA left behind from the crime scene in the murder, and compare it to Mr. Day's DNA, and it was a direct match.
And that must have been another euphoric moment.
Yes, yes.
Officer Steve Smogoreski wasn't allowed to talk about the Potomac River rapist case in 2020, and he's still not. That's because police announced in November of 2019, Smuggs had found him.
I'm Pete Newsham. I'm the chief of police for the Metropolitan Police Department here in D.C. Between 1991 and 1998, a man terrorized our community as he brutally preyed upon and attacked multiple women across this region. Today, joined by law enforcement partners, we collectively are announcing that an arrest has been made of a man who is known as the Potomac River Rapist.
That's next in Episode 6 of Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, written by me, Paul Wagner, with editorial assistance from Jack Moore, Julia Ziegler, and Craig Schwab. This episode would not be possible without the help of Officer Steve Smogoreski and retired D.C. detectives Dean Comby and Mike Farish. Reporting and production of this podcast was supported by a grant from Spotlight D.C., Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism. For grants, please apply to spotlightdc.org. Our show relies on people like you leaving ratings and reviews on Apple to help us climb the podcast charts and attract new listeners. We hope if you like what you hear, you will take a minute to do so. If you have questions or comments about the show, send us an email through our website, AmericanNightmarePodcast.com. We are also on Twitter and Facebook at AM Nightmare Pod. The music in the show is Ethereal Thoughts by Olive Musique and Steadfast by Moments. And as always, thanks for listening.